Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. A reading from her poetry and a conversation featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Rita Dove this week on Soundings. Also participating on the program this week is Helen Vendler, a professor of English at Harvard University and poetry critic for The New Yorker. Rita Dove is the author of Thomas and Beulah, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 1987. Reading from The Yellow House on the Corner, an earlier collection of her poems, here is Rita Dove.
The poem is about translation, but it's obviously also about every creative process. The word "ur" is a Swedish word for island. The first line of the poem is instructions on how to say it, and the word itself, which is an O with two dots above it with an umlaut, is so much physically like an island, too. It's a perfect word, I think. "Ur." Shape the lips to an O. Say A. That's island. One word of Swedish has changed the whole neighborhood. When I look up, the yellow house on the corner is a galleon stranded in flowers. Around it, the wind. Even the high roar of a leaf mulcher could be the horn blast from a ship as it skirts the misted shoals. We don't need much more to keep things going. Families complete themselves and refuse to budge from the present. The present extends its glass forehead to sea, backyard breezes, scattered cardinals. And if, one evening, the house on the corner took off over the marshland, neither I nor my neighbor would be amazed. Sometimes a word is found so right it trembles at the slightest explanation. You start out with one thing, end up with another, and nothing's like it used to be, not even the future.
Rita Dove, reading from The Yellow House on the Corner. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Rita Dove is working on a new project entitled Dürer's Beauty. Talking about that and related subjects, here now are Rita Dove and Helen Vendler.
One of the experiments that you try in The Yellow House on the Corner that interested me is some experiments in historical writing, and especially in imitating the language. Say, I'm thinking of some poems like The Slave's Critique of Practical Reason, or another poem called David Walker, 1785-1830, or The Transport of Slaves from Maryland to Mississippi in 1839. These were poems with a specifically historical focus, and in some cases the use of historically accurate language, things people might really have said in the 19th century. And I wondered whether this was an experiment you wanted to continue, or whether it was a thing you tried but then decided to drop, or how do you feel about that attempt to write semi-archaic language?
Well, the attempt to do that, it was spawned actually by the sense of the language and what it could say, and its restraint, and in fact how you could incorporate horrific things with in a language of restraint, because the slave narratives are related in a very quote-unquote civilized, let's say, language that makes the events, to my mind, actually more horrible. Mm-hmm. Well, they weren't, obviously. I think the events were not, the telling of it was not more horrible than the events, but you could sense in the silences just how horrific it was. And that was the original impulse, the edge that I was exploring. I can't really tell you, Helen, if I'm going to do it again. It's not something I've abandoned as being untenable. I think more that it hasn't come up again yet. In the poems that I'm writing now, some of the poems which have to do with Albrecht Dürer, the sense of another language is coming in again.
Have you been reading Dürer's letters and notebooks, or what have you been doing to prepare for the Dürer work?
Oh, I've been reading a little bit of everything, and very haphazardly as I felt the need for it. I've been reading his letters, his diary, his treatises on, he had several treatises where he wrote a manual for young painters in which he tries to explain to them what a point is, what a line is, what a spiral is. This is incredible. And there's no language for it even in medieval German, so he's inventing it. That spirit of inquiry, that kind of...
theorizing?
Yeah, that kind of theorizing, that need to try to invent a language for what you need is also a point that's fascinating for me. But I am immersing myself in a certain way in that German and trying to find an equivalent in English which is not too strange to the ear.
You've done this with Berlioz a little, too. I mean, you had a poem about Berlioz, and I wondered whether you might be able to say something about what draws you to particular historical characters. After all, there's a large tradition of art in Germany, and Dürer is not the only artist, and any more than Berlioz is the only French composer. Why Berlioz and not Debussy? Why Dürer and not Altdorf or whatever?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Particularly in the case of Berlioz, I can't say that I can articulate why Berlioz as opposed to someone else. But with Dürer, I can say that for me, he was one of the most interesting examples of an inquisitive mind, really poised, I think, between two eras, who sensed that the Renaissance was happening, and that Germany was somehow behind, and that the dark kind of iconical representations in medieval German art were going to change. And he didn't know what was coming after that, but he was willing to move outside of mere art, in his case, and go into philosophy and into mathematics. He was willing to move out to try to figure out, to stretch himself. That, of course, is one of the things that always interests me when a historical character occurs to me, but I have no rules for choosing them. They choose me.
They choose you. Can we go back a little to your work in museum? I wanted to ask you about the differences in the titles of your three volumes. First, The Yellow House on the Corner, which seems to be a domestic title, then Museum, which seems to be a different sort of title, and finally, the Thomas and Beulah, who seem to be in some way modeled somewhat on your grandparents, an interesting double sequence. The titles are so very different. I wanted to ask you about them, what you might say about them.
Looking back at them now, there was an impulse after The Yellow House in the Corner, which I did conceive as a very domestic kind of title, but one on the edge of domesticity. I mean, the house is on the corner, and there's a sense of something beyond that. Outside of that boundary, there is something else. That after that, I wanted a title. First of all, just technically, I wanted a shorter title. The poems in Museum are concerned with matters of art, matters of, I think, artifacts, too. How do you retain culture and make it available to another generation? What gets chosen and what doesn't. I suppose if you would compare it to cinematographic techniques, it's the zoom back, you know, the pull back from the lens to take in a larger picture. Thomas and Beulah, well, obviously their names, the names of the two characters, Thomas and Beulah, and I chose them in that order because it sounds better than Beulah and Thomas. Also because Thomas's section occurs first and Beulah, the name Beulah, I think, contains sound-wise much more longing and resonance than Thomas. It's the lingering tone. But interesting for me as I was writing those poems was that I had originally intended to have a section of poems dealing with Thomas, a section dealing with his wife Beulah, and then a section dealing with the town that they lived in, Akron. And I started some of those poems and aborted it, realized that in fact the town would emerge through them or not at all.
Yes.
So that in a way, looking back on it, I can see that though the first two books are places and areas of containment, that has been already subsumed in Thomas and Beulah.
And now you're doing a book called Grace Notes. Is that a pun?
Of course. Oh. It is, since the book has just been finished, it's very hard to talk about it. But when I, with the title Grace Notes, I had several things in mind, every possible meaning of grace and of notes and of grace notes and also a little added riff. Mm-hmm. In a way, it was a sense of trying to counter the kind of heavy weight of Thomas and Beulah, which was such a big, such a scope.
What has interested me the most about your poetry, I think, is its extraordinary concision. You say so much with so few words, and everything is condensed into a very pregnant set, often of images. And when you mentioned cinematography just now, and I know you've done some work in with a collaborator, a colleague in photography, I wondered whether that concision comes to you as images which crystallize in a certain way. I'm thinking of the images in the poems about adolescence, or the single image in Parsley about the parrot, or the images in the single image of the painting in the title poem of Museum, where the collocations of forms are very strong, or many of the ones in Thomas and Beulah, too, where you have the image of the banjo hanging on the wall that begins to stand for the abandoned earlier life of Thomas, or the image of the ballerina dancing in the last poem about Beulah on the little jewel box. I mean, these things seem to focus very strongly and enable you to be as concise as you are.
It is true that in Thomas and Beulah, at various points in the composition of that book, I was conscious of the fact that I had toeholds, let's say, that as I was working through a poem, I would go back to the mandolin. Mm-hmm. For instance, even if it didn't appear in this next poem, it stood there as some kind of not so much, I don't want to say an image or totem, which suggests that it's impenetrable, but almost like an oracle in a way, something that I could ask questions of and explore further that way. But I would also say just as much, though I think there are kind of photographic takes that I'll do, that it is also just as much the way that language can be telescoped to contain much more. Sometimes I find myself moving through the syntax as well.
Do you, that's true, your syntax is as compressed as your language. Do you make poems that are longer and then cut them down, or do they start off as very small and get added to?
It depends on the poem. I tend to write in fragments. I do tend to work on several poems at once, so that very often a poem will exist only as a line or two, and there are several other poems like that, and then it gets added to bit by bit. I think, though, there is a lot of editing down. Poems rarely, I don't start out with a five-page rambling thing and then it goes down to one page. It doesn't work that way.
Can you tell me, there are, so far you've been a writer of lyrics and of short stories. You mentioned that you're now writing a novel, and this is a large, long-scale departure, big departure for you in scale. Is it coming in little bits, too? Are you working on several chapters at once, or is it going in a sequential way, or does it have an overarching form into which you are putting the writing, or how is that going?
It's terrifying. It's not coming in little bits. It's coming in scenes, and they aren't all, I'm not doing it sequentially either. Though I have an idea of, I know what it's about, but I'm sure that's going to change as I go along. I had started writing it several years ago and had put it away and then started to revise it and then left it alone, and now I'm coming back. And I'm writing a novel mainly because it's a story that I wanted to tell, and and it wouldn't leave me alone. But another part of me has, I think it's always, it's the dutiful daughter or something who was always told that if you don't understand something, you should study it until you can understand it. You try, you don't run away from it. So as a writer, I just feel that if I have the idea for a novel and at one point some desire to write it, I should try it. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to turn back from it. I'm not sure I'm going to be good at it, but I'm going to try.
Well, poets' novels have an interest all their own. They're a subgenre in the history of the novel. and I think that the exploration of form always has benefits or byproducts, it seems to me, in some larger scale exploration of form that you are engaged in. I wonder if any of the labels that could be attached to you, that you're a woman writer, that you're a black writer, that you're an American writer, that you're a contemporary writer, have meaning for you, and to what extent your work comes out of these sociological grids into which you might be said to fit.
Kim, I could answer all of the above. Certainly, I come out of all of those, and they impinge on my writing at all times, in a way. Though first and foremost, it is the language that is my clay, and that's my primary interest. And I try not to think about it, certainly when I'm writing. But I'm also positive that the fact that I am a woman, and that I am a black, and that I am an American, and that I'm living in the time that I'm living now has enormous impact on my writing, and probably not only on the content, but certainly on the way it's presented, or what I feel impelled to write about. For instance, just the notion that when I was growing up and I could not find anything written about what it was like to grow up as a black woman, I mean, or mm-hmm. a girl child, or whatever you want to call it, a woman child, was something that I wanted that book, and so I'm going to try to write those poems too. I mean, obviously I can't force them, but obviously that's a lack that I'm trying to fill. It's a hole that I'm trying to fill. In terms of labels, though, in terms of whether I, you know, want to be called one thing or another, I think I want to be called a poet. If someone, I'm also a black poet, I'm a woman poet, if that means that my books get filed in the women's studies section or in the black history section and not cross-listed mm-hmm. in the general literature section, then I say no. But that's someone else's problem and not mine, really.
That's true. And I think that you will be found in many sections, I hope anyway. Seems to me you will be. One of the things that has interested me in your poetry has been specifically what you just mentioned, the bringing into visibility many things that were hitherto invisible. I felt that very strongly about your poems about adolescence, of which there are many, Holly Golly and the two adolescence ones and so on, that there were experiences that had never been articulated before. And often when I've taught those poems, students are just astonished, especially about the seal man in the bathroom in adolescence, that such things can be brought into visibility. They're almost shocked at having things made visible that they had thought should be kept under wraps, so to speak. And I think of this as true of the parents of the poems about your grandparents, insofar as they are. I say that because there's a photo, I gather, of your grandparents on the cover of Thomas and Beulah, that there's a life that might not have been recorded that has been brought into visibility, including things like the Goodyear picnic for the workers, and including things like Beulah's reminiscences while she's dusting. These are already poems, especially dusting, that have become very well known. Is there any sense in which, as you bring things into visibility, other things occur to you lying around that need to be brought into visibility too? Do you have a kind of sense of maternity as something that needs to be brought into visibility, or how does this appeal to you?
It's fascinating. The question is fascinating for me as a writer because it really gets into how a writer continues, how they build on what they've done before, what others have done, and what has been satisfied for the time being, what still gnaws on one. And I think that particularly in Thomas and Beulah, in bringing certain things to light, I discovered other things beneath them. And one of the things that happened writing Thomas and Beulah, particularly with Beulah's section, was that the whole notion of maternity and children and motherhood and all of that stuff, that these things began to come to light. And I realized that I was, in fact, feeding some of my own experiences as a young mother into Beulah. And at the same time, feeling incredibly uncomfortable about it until I realized that there had been this kind of unspoken notion that poems about children and mothers are mushy and bad, and you know, you just don't write those things. And once I became aware of that, I realized that, of course, what I had to do was to write these poems, and that I was covering up a part of my own life that was very important. Technically, that meant I had to work with poems, write poems which were much closer to my present state, which was also good for me, I think. So, in fact, in the next book, in Grace Notes, there are some poems about motherhood.
Those, I think, are the hardest poems to write. I've often been struck by the fact that someone like, say, Adrienne Rich, who did have three children, has represented that almost not at all in a long career with many books, as though it were an unrepresentable part of her experience, though her experience with men and women in love and friendship and her experience with her parents and her grandparents has all been brought into representation. The one thing that has escaped seems to be the representation of motherhood, except, interestingly enough, in her prose of Woman Born, which is not a specific personal memoir, but talks about motherhood in general. But it seems to have escaped lyric treatment. It's one of the things I'm interested in, is how things are brought into lyric treatment. And you did it, as you said, by going through Beulah in one instance, but presumably the later poems are more directly first person, are they?
They are first person, and they were brought not only into view not only because of Beulah, but in fact because of a project that I had started with a photographer, a woman photographer at Arizona State, where we were going to work together to create images and poems, and we started not knowing what we were going to do, with no preconceived notions, and simply wandered around until we found a space we could work in, which turned out to be my backyard, and we started writing about backyards. Children started coming into it, and so it became absolutely necessary that I talk about that aspect of domesticity.
Well, that's an interesting notion of another backyard to add to Archie Ammon's backyard. His backyard doesn't have too many children in it, so he knows it'll be a different backyard. Can you tell me, do you feel generationally accompanied in your work in the exploration of language, form, what have you? You were in a cohort, say, at Iowa. You are in a cohort of young writers that you probably know in Germany as well as in America. Is there any sense of what your generation is up to that you could convey to us?
My generation is so diverse. In the United States, I can't speak for any other country universally, but it's so diverse. I think what's very interesting lately is this drive toward narrative, which is coming up, which is, I think, a response to a very heady kind of disembodied lyric. I'm not sure where we're heading. I don't feel particularly accompanied by anyone in my generation, though there are people whose work I admire and I follow. I think we're all kind of stumbling along. I feel accompanied by earlier generations. And I mean, I think that for me, Rilke accompanies me. Derek Walcott accompanies me in a funny kind of way. Toni Morrison does. And Heinrich Heine does. And that kind of list
goes
on.
Anybody from England?
Oh, God, England. Well, Shakespeare, of course. But I'm trying to think if there's anyone else.
That's interesting in itself.
Yeah, I guess it
speaks, says something about the present cohort of poets here who are much more likely to be influenced by Rilke or Neruda or Milosz or somebody than by somebody in England. It's a kind of turn of influence in American literature, I think, that
that's true.
Other Americans and foreigners, but not so likely the English. That's an interesting testimony. I think that our time is almost up. I wonder if you could say what you find hardest about writing. For me, that's always a question for a writer.
Hardest.
That interests me. What is it that makes you look at a blank page day after day after day after day? Is there a certain thing that is more of a block than anything else, or that you find overcoming more of a joy than anything else?
I think that that is constantly changing. That in the end, I am in a dialogue with myself and also with the entire culture that I am immersed in, but that I find different things hardest all the time. Sometimes it's simply putting down the first word, and sometimes it's having a fairly well-written poem in front of me that has no gut at all. And but different things keep rearing their heads as impossible at that moment.
That's a good answer. Thank you, Rita.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation featuring Rita Dove and Helen Vendler. In 1987, Rita Dove won the Pulitzer Prize for her book of poems, Thomas and Beulah. Helen Vendler teaches at Harvard University, writes about poetry for The New Yorker, and serves as a trustee of the National Humanities Center. During her fellowship year at the center, Rita Dove is at work on a new project entitled Durer's Beauty. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 452. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about recent critical perspectives on the plays of William Shakespeare. My guests will be Alan Sinfield of the University of California at Berkeley and Jonathan Dollimore of the University of Sussex. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in May and the first week in June mark an anniversary for the first recorded earthquake in America, which occurred at Plymouth Plantation in late May 1638. During the end of May 1889, flooding at Johnstown, Pennsylvania, resulted in the loss of more than 2,000 lives. The comic sports ballad, Casey at the Bat, first appeared in early June 1888 in the San Francisco Examiner. Its then-anonymous author was Ernest L. Thayer. Finally, the poet Walt Whitman, the actress Marilyn Monroe, and the Mormon polygamist Brigham Young have birthdays during the end of May and the first part of June. Walt Whitman was born in 1819, Marilyn Monroe in 1926, and Brigham Young in 1801. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
A reading from her poetry and a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Rita Dove, this week on Soundings. Listen also for Helen Vendler, a professor of English at Harvard University and poetry critic for The New Yorker. Rita Dove reads from her collection, The Yellow House on the Corner, and she and Helen Vendler discuss her current work. The poet, the poem, and the critic. This week on Soundings.